Welcome to Apple Pie Playground, where we serve up slices of healing for the heart. Stay tuned for a journey of transformation back to the divine inner child. Can you come out and play today?
Welcome, everyone, to Apple Pie Playground. I'm your host, Valerie. We are inviting our divine inner child out to play, as always, which means we are guided by our authentic self, and we like it that way. And we love to be guided by you, BBS, and thank you for doing what you do best on the other side of the microphones. Thank you so much, BBS. You know, friends, we are a world in contact, and I want to thank you for being here, everyone, on a wonderful Sunday afternoon. I have had occasion to reflect on a few vocabulary words that I've used over the last few Sundays, and I'm realizing that there's so much more behind those words. There are ideas we can navigate together that truly prove a 21st century convergence of science and spiritualism and truth-telling in what we're talking about when we discuss the energetics of the human spirit. And I want to prove out the science of a few ideas, like the torus functions of our hearts, right? And how the heart is a vortex. And I want to put that idea together to discuss the vortices of space-time that kind of connect our reality to higher dimensions. And then I want to share a little bit of a fun insight into what it might really mean to exude a magnetic personality. So if we're in, let's get started. I want to start by asking us all to try to visualize in our mind's eye the scene in the Garden of Eden when a serpent gave Eve an apple and told her that it in fact would not kill her, but give her the wisdom of God. Can we picture that scene in our minds? Maybe we're thinking about what we learned a long time ago in Sunday school, maybe. And that's okay. The Bible narrates that Adam was told not to eat of the tree of knowledge, okay? And here comes Eve with an apple, and oh boy, what does she do? And so do we see that in our mind's eye? Okay, we're going to come back to that scene in just a little while. And I want to tempt you with that imagery because of what the apple, and actually many fruits for that matter, actually represent energetically. Okay, so we'll come back to the image that we have in our minds a little later. And so recently, I have been thinking about what it takes to be a confident person. Okay, to be self-assured with a magnetism that draws things to us, people and opportunity. And I'm not talking about manifestation. Okay, I'm not talking about manifestation. I'm talking about the bioelectric magnetism that our body's energy field operates with. I'm talking about the energy we create and send out and the energy we receive from others. And I've been wondering how that connects to ideas like confidence and curiosity and self-love, right? Self-assurance. And I want to talk about it for a minute. It all goes back to the heart's energy. It's Taurus and our internal vortex that connects us vibrationally to levels of what folks actually call dimensionality. Okay, so that's where we're going. But I want to start in the brain. Okay, let's start with the brain and its operating system. Okay, and our emotion bodies and what we do when we optimize the energies in positive ways throughout our bodies. Okay, so what does confidence look like in our brains? Okay, what's going on up there to produce what we feel as confidence? So here's the thing. It's a catch-22, all right? The truth is we have to act confident in order to help the brain to believe it, right? And replicate it as a mental experience. And I don't mean act like it or fake it, right? Faking confidence. I mean acting as if we are in fact confident. And there's a difference here. And I did not know that this difference existed. But there is a difference between those two things. Faking it, right? And then acting as if in fact we are confident. And faking it, it's a noble, it's a brave thing to do. Okay, it's a brave, brave thing to do, but it's not integrative. Okay, when we fake it, it's not integrative. Well, what does that mean? In other words, if we don't believe it's true, if we don't believe it's true, then the brain won't believe it. Okay, does that make sense? So rather than faking it, we engage our goal as if we are already it. We are already confident. Now, that's not easy sometimes. That first shaky step toward confidence can be a real game changer, though. When we act as if something is already true for us. And then what happens is the brain takes over. Okay, it's like, yeah, you did the hard part. Now I'm going to take over now. And reconstructs the intention in a few key ways. Okay, first, the brain synchronizes the logical parts of itself, okay? It synchronizes all of those critical thinking parts, the planning centers of the brain, okay? The prefrontal cortex fires up, right? And this is where our self-concept is formed, and it's reinforced there in the prefrontal cortex. It's what's called the executive center, the executive control center of the rational part of the brain. Okay, so conceptually, we are telling the control center that we are confident and calm and self-assured enough to make good choices that are reasonable and responsible. And this calms the nervous system down chemically, right? Chemically, energetically, emotionally, and it allows the brain to lower its defenses against threats of harm. All right? And that's a lot going on when we make one decision. right? When we decide that we are going to feel confident, which is most certainly not always easy, right? And as a matter of fact, I'm going to go out on a limb and I'm going to say it might be one of the hardest things humans have to do. If for no other reason than having been traumatized and trained away from using the prefrontal cortex in favor of keeping us in fight or flight mode in the reptilian brain, down in the back and the bottom of the brain, right? Instead of the top front, it seems to be that the dark systems of control, right, want to keep us at the in the back at the bottom. Okay, does that make sense? And so what happens is our amygdala is a part of the brain responsible for threat control. And we've talked about this. And when we presume to be confident, then we quiet the amygdala down, right? Otherwise, our worry and our fear and our frustration keeps it firing and keeps it ready to try to be ready for all of the possible threats that could come its way. And when we lack confidence, that's exactly what's happening in our brain. Okay, that's exactly what's happening. The brain is bracing for our failure. That's what's going on. So the brain is either helping us produce success or it's helping us produce failure, friends. Right? It's one or the other. And, you know, I wish there were other nuances of our mental state, but not so much, you know, not so much, friends. So does it make sense that we might want to reconsider what we call our experiences of failure? As a matter of ensuring our brains maintain evidence of confidence, right? Positive mindset means our failure equals something different to the brain, okay? It means that our failure equals learning to the brain, right? It equals an interesting challenge for the prefrontal cortex rather than a matter of falling into fear, right? Into threat, into sort of that red light warning that sets the brain off. It pulls us out of the rational, self-assuring, self-soothing part of the brain. And that self-concept or identity is linked to our mindset. The brain is triggered by what we think of ourselves, right? Through expressions of confidence or expressions of fear and doubt. Okay, it's one or the other. And the brain builds a story around those expressions, whichever one we choose, as a matter of protecting itself, right? That's its number one job. And that story that it creates, right, that it builds, it creates predictability in the mind. And we've talked about this. Predictability is key for the brain. The brain perpetuates a consistent storyline. Identity matters. Now, the brain doesn't necessarily care if we are traumatized to the point of constant, consistent fear, as long as it can create a predictable storyline, right? So it's a prediction machine. The brain is a prediction machine. When it senses we are confident And it can trust us to pull our focus into the logical part of the brain. We're able to predict outcomes better, which means we're able to make better decisions, think things through, and prove to the brain that we are ensuring our safety through what? Our confidence. Okay? And when you think about it, it's how folks like firefighters and emergency medical technicians and rescue personnel and military forces are able to do what they do. They learn confidence first, and they integrate it into a subconscious program so that confidence is automatic for the brain. Okay? And the mind stays in success mode, in confidence, even through hazard and danger and risk. So let's think about this. Isn't a big part of confidence how we deal with failure? And it means dealing with failure in ways that don't damage our self-concept, right? Our identity, and move us out of our rational mental processes, right? Through a lot of conscious awareness, we can automate the experience of safety and success and confidence in the subconscious mind, right? And it does take work, and we know this. We're doing the good work of pairing our conscious selves with our subconscious through mindfulness and introspection and observing lifestyles of conscious awareness, right? And contemplation and getting quiet and sitting still. And we're learning to synchronize the conscious and the subconscious, to understand the synchronicities and the signs and the symptoms, and to interpret what comes through and use it in a positive way, understand what we are receiving as information from the subconscious and building it into the conscious mind. And pairing that, right, means that we are learning to observe our lives without a tug of war of sensory input that pushes and pulls us in and out of our peace. Right? We are learning to maintain a balance. Mind, body, and spirit. We are replacing fears of failure with confidence, creating resilience and flexibility in the way we problem solve, so the brain sees it as the normal course of business. Do we see that? And yes, that's a lot of work. That's the good work that we're doing, friends. That is the good work that we are doing. We are building a foundation on which to attract and integrate conscious awareness, right? That's what we're doing, the good work we're doing. I was listening this week to a presentation suggesting that one's peace is not just important for ourselves, but for others who would trust us, right? In relationships, our peace creates a safe harbor. And we want to believe that love is enough for a relationship. But if we aren't projecting the confidence of our own peace and its value, then are we serving others with a love that is fearful and maybe unreliable? And I sat and I thought about that, because confidence is foundational for our peace, as it turns out. It produces a lasting peace, which is an immovable peace, not because we learn to always be right or never to fail or never to have doubt, but because we are aligning ourselves, mind, body, and spirit, with a physical process that resonates success as safety and rationality and trustworthiness in the brain. And therefore, when our heart moves its energy up and down our nervous system and connects it with the brain that desperately needs the heart's guidance, that desperately needs to regulate a nervous system, we can use confidence as a beautiful tool in that alignment, right? And this is what I listened to in a very intriguing presentation this week. And it's all about the signals that we send ourselves that command our reality. And I suppose that the same might be said of relationships too. Human relations function on the basis of confidence, just like the brain. We are either confident or we are fearful. It's sort of a pendulum swing, isn't it? Eventually, we're going to be in one place or the other. And wherever we are is going to attract or it's going to repulse. And our peace then is the deciding factor. It's what frees us, and it's a matter of confidence. It's a matter of confidence. So why is it that I'm talking about confidence when I started the show describing things like torus fields and vortices, and is that a little bit curious, anybody? Well, as energy bodies, we create a flow inside of us that integrates a resonance around us. Okay? And we know this. We are essentially energies bumping into each other all day long. And we are deciding how to interpret that, how to integrate that. Right? We're either colliding or we're integrating with the life force all around us and with each other. And the energy we emit creates a pulse pattern. Okay? And the more that we know about the idea of source consciousness, the more that we understand that life force is a matter of patterning, the repetition of patterning that pulls from possibility predictable behaviors and manifestations and events, right? And so knowing that, it helps us understand that it fires at a certain strength and force, right? These patterns of energy that we produce in our heart space, for example. Just like the idea of confidence boosting the brain to fashion a reality of success and safety, right? To optimize this process in the brain to its fullest function. Well, our energy bodies do the same thing. We radiate our internal reality outward. Does that make sense? We are generating in a broader field a signature of what's going on inside of us, right? And we can't help it. Everything is energy, and energy doesn't lie. And we know this. And so with that in mind, I watched a lecture on sacred geometry this week presented by the Vesica Institute. And the lecture is called The Torus and the Spiral, presented by Dr. Robert Gilbert, the Vesica Institute. Okay, you can find lots of stuff online, the Vesica Institute. And it turns out that research exists on the heart all the way back to the 70s that suggests an energetic responsibility of the function of the heart, not just a physical one, but an energetic responsibility of the heart to do what it does. Okay, research all the way back a long time ago. And this research didn't, it wasn't any kind of spiritual kind of research. It was purely medical. Okay, it was purely medical, and it was research on cardiac arrhythmia, right? That generated some really provocative results about the energy of the heart. And the research discovered that every time the heart pulses, it creates a biogeometrical pattern that we call a torus field. Okay, and this is mainstream scientific research. Okay. The heart's pulsing creates a biogeometric pattern, an observable pattern that we call a torus field. Okay, we call it a toroidal field. Okay, the literature of the day called it a torus field. And the torus field is made up of a lot of concentric tori. Okay, functioning together in a pattern that produces the rhythmic electromagnetic pulse of our hearts. Okay, it by firing themselves off in a pattern. So what does that mean? Well, a torus is most easily described as a donut-shaped energy field. So if you can think of a donut and then visualize it with many, many, many circles framing the donut shape, right? That's a simple image of a torus or a toroidal field. And we're used to calling it a toroidal field as we talk about it. So we can think of an apple as a torus form. So imagine an apple, you cut the apple in half, and we have the circular arc of the fruity flesh that radiates around its seed bed where the axis is there in the middle of the apple. And this torus shape is a biogeometric form that keeps its shape and its function even when it expands. So no matter how big the apple grows, right, it is going to keep its biogeometric form. It's going to keep its shape, and it's going to continue to perform its energetic function. no matter how small it gets, no matter how big it gets. And we find these torus fields in every living thing, every subatomic atom, right, to the defining nature of the cosmos itself. That's how large we get. Okay, can we imagine that? So the torus is a primary form in sacred geometry. It integrates energy flow into the creation process itself, and we'll talk about that. So the torus of our hearts is electromagnetic in nature, and with every heartbeat, energy moves in and out as a pattern of pulses, okay, which keeps its form and its function as it extends or radiates out from the body. Now, this is important when you think about other ideas like connecting physicality to higher dimensional grids or dimensional places or spaces in our conscious environment, right? In our quantum environment. Because we need something that is going to maintain its energetic form and its energetic function to stay materially dependable. Does that make sense? Right? And so the interesting thing is, science is moving ever closer to this idea. And I want to quote, "We can bring in a divine essence and circulate it through an energetic field." And that's what we were just talking about. We can use what is a dependable torus in form and function as a primary building block of every single thing in existence. And we can prove that out into other dimensional experiences outside of the material realm. And the exciting thing about that is that we can begin to talk about consciousness as a driving force in this energetic expression of our material world. And that's exciting. So, is that what we can point to as intelligent design? Right? I mean, can we say that? Is this evidence of source consciousness entering the physical realm? And are we able to begin to start talking about what that looks like mathematically, what that looks like in the realm of science and physics and quantum? Can we make the quote unquote quantum leap? Right? Well, I think we can. I think we do already, honestly, but that's a different topic. But so let's think about it. Can we imagine God as the quantum fields of all that is flowing through our hearts? We align with the field and resonate with it, and it fills us energetically. Right? It's an infinite loop of energy, an endless flow of life force. Okay, does that make sense? Our energy field is a closed system. Okay? And as a closed system, it flows through us, but it's also connected to everything around it because it can adopt the form and function, right, in a consistent pattern. Does that make sense? When we optimize our energy, when we produce a robust pattern of flow, just think of a heartbeat, and we've got good rhythm in our heart. It's nice, it's healthy, it's flowing, it is beating the way it needs to. There's a vortex in there moving energy in and out, a double vortex moving energy in and out there, creating a robust pattern of flow. What is going on is a representation of what we can call balancing the polarity of our energy. Right? We are balancing the opposing forces at work in our field, which means we're keeping a balance between the inward contraction of our torus field and the outward expansion of it. Okay, and that keeps the form and function of our flow of energy, right? The balance is energy without polarity. It is optimal energy flow in our body, right? When we experience an energy flow that is completely, perfectly balanced, it is optimized energetically, we are experiencing energy without polarity. Right? Do we see how balance is the key to everything, friends? Right? So why the conversation then on confidence when we're talking about this idea of removing polarity through a perfection in our energy flow? Right? Well, because we increase our toroidal field or decrease it, it could go either way, depending on how we use our energy, the strength and patterning of our energy flow, right? Positive emotion in the body creates what is called physiological coherence. Okay? Physiological coherence. Let me get that word right. Physiological coherence. It's a thing. I can't say it very well, but it's a thing. The greater our physical positivity, the better our brains are at being assured of safety, success, and predictability, the more confident we are, the more optimized our heart's torus field. And the better it patterns a consistent energy flow, the stronger our electromagnetic field, the more radiating that field is outward. Okay? And according to the lecture that I listened to, this electromagnetic field can stretch hundreds and possibly thousands of miles. In fact, it can roll out immeasurably, if you can imagine that. That was the model presented. Okay? So imagine this. We affect a planet of people with our energies. Imagine it. Imagine what we do to a room of people when we walk in or when we walk out. So do you remember when I said we would return to the apple in the biblical Adam and Eve story? What do we think of the apple now and what it might have been in that story, maybe? Adam and Eve were told not to eat from the tree of knowledge. And knowledge etymologically means growing into knowing. And so, why were Adam and Eve never to grow into their knowing? How can that be? How can first man and first woman in human creation not be expected or allowed to grow in their knowing? I mean, let's think about ourselves. We ourselves are trying to grow in our knowing, and we equate our efforts to remembering who we are as divine beings. Does it make sense that Adam and Eve would be forbidden to do the same thing? And what does the apple represent in the story? I mean, to receive an apple of all things, it's a perfect representation of a torus or a toroidal field. When you think about it, it's a perfect example of how to use energy to evolve into higher consciousness. So why could they not avail themselves of the knowledge of energy fields that would create higher conscious awareness inside of them? Does it make sense? And when they did eat the apple, they realized they were naked. Did they not, for the first time, realize the manifest difference between what was spirit and what was flesh of a material world? Did they not become self-aware, maybe, as newly conscious beings? And, you know, what if I told you that the story goes that they were gifted this knowledge as beings who received the spark of God out of a higher love for the creation of man, even if man were not initially intended to have it? And what if we believe the first stories about the serpent as a seraphim of the throne of God, maybe, dispatched by Sophia to the garden as the bringer of Christos to man? What do we think about that? Maybe there's more to think about. So, what does it really mean to have a magnetic personality? You know, at the beginning, we talked about how we would end our time together thinking about all of the things that we have discussed today and how it results in the confidence that creates a magnetic personality. And, you know, what does that mean to be able to draw people in? What is it, you know, all about anyway? So in quantum terminology, there's actually a term for it that's called ferromagnetic exchange interaction. And I'm not even kidding about that. Ferromagnetic exchange interaction. It means when you enter a room and your energy is in a highly coherent state, it's stabilized, it's optimized, it's balanced, it's synchronized, then your energy is like a magnet that pulls the energy of everybody else into alignment closer to yours or into greater coherence or resonance. So it's why maybe a room of grumpy folks is maybe not so fun, right? It's why when we're grumpy, it's not so fun for the folks around us, and we could all lose resonance together if we're not very, very careful. So, do you want to test the idea of a magnetic personality together a little bit before we have to go? Do you want to play a little bit? So let's test this. Okay, all we need is something to write on or something to write with, right? All we need is a little bit of paper, maybe a pen or a pencil. And some of us like to use our notebooks so we can return to the exercises and reflect a little bit, but we don't have to. So if we're doing this exercise on paper, we want to take a minute and draw three columns down your page. And that might just be a couple of lines you draw down the page to make sure you get three columns. And we'll be putting information in each of three columns. Okay, so if you have your paper, go ahead and make your three columns, a couple of lines down the page, and let's label those columns. Okay, so let's label column one as how people react to me. Okay, that's column one, how people react to me. All right, that's the label for column one. The label for or heading for column two is my social impact. Okay, that's the heading for column two, my social impact. All right. And so let's label column three, and the heading for that is my characteristics. Okay, column three. Heading my characteristics. Okay, do we have it? Three columns, three headings. And so now let's think back to the last time you were in a room with other people in an organized way. Okay, the last time. A very memorable time, right? That you were in a group of people, okay? A memorable time. It doesn't really matter how many people were there, but you want a group, right? You want enough of a group to be able to sort of measure what was going on in social terms, okay? So let's think about this. Let's get that memory in our mind. Let's try to visualize as specifically as we can this memory, very memorable time of being in a group of folks. Maybe it was a conference, maybe it was a meeting or a training, or maybe it was something at work, or it was something out that you were doing as as downtime or an activity with friends or what have you. Just a big group of people. And let's try to think of how it felt. Let's remember how we felt. Let's remember as much as we can the kinds of interactions we engaged. And let's try to see what we can remember about this gathering as specifically as we can. Okay. And we might have some emotions popping up about it too, and that's okay. It could be, really informative if we do. Folks might pop up, maybe people we remember or personalities or whatever the case may be. That can all be very informative. So, do we have a scene in our mind? Okay, let's work with it. We're gonna reflect. Okay, and we're going to try to be as clear as we can about the experience. And we're not going to worry if if we can't remember a lot. Let's just use our overall impressions. If we can, that'll go a long way. We're going to turn our attention to column one. Okay, the heading is how people reacted to me. And we're going to jot down a few notes based on some questions that I'm going to ask. Okay, let's ask a few questions. We're going to write down a few answers, jot down a few notes, and a few words or impressions about each of the questions that I ask. Okay, are we ready? Here are some questions we'll answer for this column. Column one, how people reacted to me. Okay, so let's think about this. Did people in the room walk up to us and introduce themselves. Let's think about it. Okay, did people hold conversations with us? Let's think about that. Did they confide in us in some way? Are there ways that folks were confiding information with us? We can jot some things down if memory serves, right? Do we remember anyone sharing an opinion about something or somebody? Do we remember folks sharing opinions about something or somebody? Did folks look to see what our reactions to their comments were? Did folks look to see how we were reacting to their comments? Did they want our approval? Did anybody remember us as a new acquaintance from somewhere? Okay, those are questions for column one. All right, let's just sort of put that information in there. We're going to move to column two. Okay, column two, and that heading is my social impact. Okay, my social impact. Let's think about this. First question, did the stress or excitement around us calm down when we sat down or we went to stand with a group maybe? Did the stress or the excitement calm down? What was our effect on the group? Let's think about that. Maybe we were at a table of people. Okay, did people relax with us being there at the table or in the setting we were in? Did they have a heightened attentiveness to us? Did people stop talking and listen to us when we spoke? Let's think about that. Did people offer us a seat or pull up a chair for us or maybe make a space for us to stand together with them in a group of people? Did people touch us on our arm or our elbow or our shoulder or our back? Did people touch us? Let's think about that. Did people find our eyes and try to hold our attention? Right? What do we remember? Okay, last column, column three, my characteristics. Okay, column three, my characteristics. First question, did we feel comfortable in our own skin? Did we feel confident in ourselves that day? Did we feel confident in ourselves that day? Were we at ease? Were we smiling, right, at folks? Maybe as they spoke, or maybe looking around at the crowd. Were we smiling? Were we engaging with others? Did we touch anyone on the arm or the shoulder or the back? Did we touch anyone? Did we offer others our undivided attention Maybe when they were talking or when there was a presentation? Or were we preoccupied? Maybe we were reading something, or we were on our phones, or we were eating something. Do we remember where our attention was? Did we try to make eye contact with everybody at the table or in the group at one point or another? Did we use body language to show interest in what was going on, like leaning in or leaning forward or nodding our heads? Did we use body language? And did we feel like our authentic selves? Did we feel like our authentic selves? So that was for column three. Let's take a minute and think about what we've written or what we remember and we've observed about our particular memory. And let's ask ourselves, on a scale of 1 to 10, how magnetic we think we might have been on this one particular event or this one particular time. Okay, a scale of 1 to 10. We want to stay away from judging, right? We don't really want to judge. We're just trying to kind of get a sense here. We're taking a look at our pattern of behavior to see what we remember, right? And that's important because we're going to ask ourselves a final question. All right, and try to think of an answer. And I'm going to give you some space to think of an answer before I say it to see what you come up with. Okay? Do we know the single greatest indicator of our magnetism? Do we know what that is? The single greatest indicator of our magnetism. In any environment, in a group, or as we are out and about in a public place. Do we know? What decides how magnetic we are at any given time? Well, I'll tell you. The greatest indicator that personal magnetism will work in a room of people is our level of active presence, our engagement with the people that we're around. Okay? Because we are activating our energy, we are sending it out to resonate. And we are activating other folks' energy, and it bounces back in a reflexive loop that we were talking about today. And it takes us actively sharing our energy to create that magnetism that we're talking about, that's interactive experience. I'm wondering if your answer was sort of along the same lines. And we can always learn to do that better or more mindfully, right? To engage people and vibe with them better and better as we go. I kind of thought that was a fun and a really instructive exercise for me, and I hope it was for you too. We haven't played in a while, and so that was super fun for me, and I really, really hope you enjoyed it. I always love we can kind of get into a little expressive play. I think it's always helpful and beneficial and super fun. For myself, friends, I think it could be true that one of the most pressing goals for humanity is to pull people back into their confidence. And I think many of us are unsettled and we are anxious and we are struggling and we are doubtful and we can't find a confident footing, which means our peace is not so easy much of the time. And I think healing our world may actually be an act of building confidence again. Building confidence again. Our good work, at least, is choosing confidence over our doubt and our fear. It's very, very instructive for me. I've been doing a lot of contemplation on that. And, you know, that choice changes everything, every single time we make it. So can we decide to be more confident, to prioritize our peacemaking, really, that forms a certain kind of energy, right? So that everyone around us can trust our energetic magnetism that creates a peace that everyone around us can trust. And that puts them at ease. And it gives them safe harbor for their own peace. And that's the work of magnetic personalities like yours, friends, right? So maybe something to think about this week. But how time flies. And I want to thank you so much for being with me this week. I really, really enjoyed our time together. And thank you, BBS, for being on the playground with us this week. As always, we love you, BBS. And until next time.
Time to head home, friends. Thanks for being a part of today's journey. We'll see you back on the playground next Sunday at 1 p.m. Central Time on bbsradio.com. Make sure to subscribe if you enjoyed the show. Find us on Telegram and X to share your insights on topics today. Your input heals the child in us all.